Welcome to this podcast. My name is Dirk Verburg, and I believe leadership determines the difference between the success and failure of organizations. Today, I'm having a conversation with Sophia Town. Sophia Town, PhD, is an assistant professor of organizational behavior at the Gabelli School of Business. As a qualitative researcher, Dr. Town explores how leaders can cultivate both knowledge and wisdom in service of individual, organizational, and societal flourishing. Dr. Town's research program reflects three primary streams of research: wisdom-based leadership, systemic change for human flourishing, and transformative business pedagogy. In the classroom, Professor Town's curriculum is guided by the question, how can we develop compassionate leaders in service of a flourishing world? Professor Town has designed and taught a number of reflective and experiential courses for the undergraduate, MBA, and executive MBA levels, covering topics such as leadership development, emotional intelligence, mindfulness, conflict management, and negotiation. Each course aims to humanize business education by fostering the knowing, doing, and being of wisdom in the workplace. Regarding transformation pedagogy, Dr. Town leads Fortum's Human Flourishing Project, FHFP, a mixed-method, interdisciplinary research lab that explores behavioral, psychological, communicative, and spiritual development in business education. Related to this project, Dr. Town serves as a research affiliate and advisory board member for the Human Flourishing Program at Harvard University. You can find her full bio, as well as a list of publications, in the show notes below. So, Sophia, thank you so much for being a guest on this podcast. As you know, the topic of this podcast is leadership, and you have done and are still doing a lot of research in this area. So we're quite keen to explore that. I guess my first question is, where does your interest in the topic of leadership stem from?
I've been interested in leadership pretty much as long as I can remember. When I was a child, I grew up in a martial arts dojo.
Yeah.
And so I grew up practicing karate. My parents, that's actually what they did professionally, was own martial arts studio. And I remember just seeing the way that some people would come into a room, even if they were a shy person out in their kind of day-to-day life, even if they weren't very extroverted, you know, they would come into a room and just captivate people with their martial arts capabilities. And I remember just thinking like, wow, this is one space where people who might not seem like leaders out there in their, you know, public life can kind of enact leadership on the dojo floor. And I was really interested in this topic. And as I got a little bit older and started studying human communication, which is what my background is, I came to this question, you know, why does it seem like when we look out into the public sphere so often, we see these highly charismatic, you know, communicatively competent people who might not be the best of intentions? And what about all the folks who have a lot of compassion, you know, social consciousness, resolve to make a change in the world, or at least not contribute to destruction in the world? You know, we have these really compassionate people who might not have the charisma or communicative competency to, you know, kind of step into the public and do something with that compassion. And I became very intrigued by that question. And so for me, it's less about leadership per se as a construct, as it is about developing kind of our human capacities to enact powerful change in our life and in our communities. And so it's more about that communication, you know, psychology, flourishing at a human level, more so than just leadership specifically. But I work in the business field because I think that's where we can make the biggest difference, because leaders have so much power over their or influence over their organizations.
I would agree. I think it is also, and what I also like about leadership in a business context is also you see if leadership works or doesn't work, because the scorecard is so incredibly clear, and you can also see if it works for the long term or if it's only, let's say, works in the short term, if you think like companies like Enron, WorldCom, etc. So I think the business world is a wonderful research area, put it that way. If you think the expectations that we have from leaders, do you think they have changed in the recent years? And if so, how have they changed?
Well, leadership used to be more akin, at least conceptually, to the idea of management. So controlling, predicting, strategizing, maintaining, you know, kind of making the machine run. And today that's just increasingly not the case. You know, I'm a professor at a business school, Fordham University here in New York, and I see my, you know, undergraduate students up through my master's students, MBA students, executive MBA students, kind of the whole age range. There is this shift happening right now with folks who are in or entering the workforce where they're really like calling on their leaders to embrace their whole selves, the employees' whole selves at work, to provide a safe, psychologically safe, physically safe space for people to go work. Yeah, and this just wasn't the case before. I think there was a lot less demand on our leaders for the emotional element or psychological element of work. Mm-hmm. And today it's shifting rapidly. So leaders have to pay attention to not only, you know, the quote unquote bottom line profit, but employee well-being, you know, environmental and financial, social sustainability, things of that nature that really weren't part of, or they were more like icing on the cake.
Yeah,
in the past,
I agree.
And now they're central.
I recognize that myself. And I just wonder, do you have any explanations why that might stem from? I mean, is that changing of the tide, changing society? Is that COVID? What generational differences? What do you think are the root causes for these kind of changes that we see in terms of different expectations people have from work and from leadership?
It's a multiplex problem. I think if you ask economists, they're going to give you one answer. If you ask, you know, medical doctors, they're going to give you another answer. Social psychologists, another answer. And really, I think it's probably yes and all of the above. One thing, though, I've done a little bit of theoretical work on this question that's under or in process right now. But one of the ideas is that there really have always been these social pressures, you know, competing demands, conflicting pressures in the environment. And
they're not new.
Related to, you know, environment and race and, you know, gender and you know, anything really that's kind of seems like an important topic in the public consciousness today. It's been there, you know, but in the past, there was always a really kind of discrete boundary between the organization and public life. And now the porosity between the organization and public life is amplified by you know, social media and things of that nature, right? Communication at scale. And so you have people out there living their life in society, you know, engaging with these important social environmental topics, bringing that consciousness into the organization, engaging at work, and then bringing it back out. And so there's just a lot more blurring of boundaries today.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good observation, because you made me think about, you know, what happened in the, you know, when the immigration was constrained under the Trump administration for a while from people stemming from certain countries and, you know, employees asking their companies to stand up and the leaders to stand up and take a stance. And I think you're absolutely right. In that sense, lines are blurring. And what's another interesting observation is what you said, that people want to bring more of themselves also to the workplace. So you have less compartmentalization than you used to have. And what do you think how do you think organizations and leaders need to handle that? What happens if leaders don't adapt to these changes of expectations of their teams and of their employees and of their direct reports? What can the implications for them be?
You know, this is a challenging problem because there's no script for it. So it's a two-part question, I think a multi-part answer. So, you know, what do leaders need to do to adapt? Well, there isn't a simple script that says, you know, in this context, always do this. Doesn't work that way. Yes, employees want to be seen as whole people at work. They want their, you know, whole person-ness to be embraced. But then sometimes they want to be left alone. They don't want to talk about what's going on in their personal life. There's, you know, so there's a boundary there too. Maybe I want to be embraced and seen for my full identity, but I don't want anyone poking their nose in my personal business, you know, in this way or that way. And so you know, wise leadership is very context specific. So there isn't a script for how to act, but there are certain kind of ways that leaders can broaden how they respond to, process, make sense of competing demands in the workplace. In fact, one of the most effective things I think leaders can do, because this way of thinking spans social, financial, strategic, kind of the whole gamut, is developing a paradox mindset. How can I work well as a leader with conflicting demands, competing, pressures, contradictory, opposing forces in the organization? How do I respond skillfully when what I'm facing is super complicated and potentially even paradoxical? So that's one thing. And that there's a way to learn how to think more paradoxically. And then the second thing is, what will happen if leaders don't adapt? Well, I think people these days are really quick to call them out, to call leaders out and say, hey, I see what you're doing or you're not doing, and this isn't acceptable. This isn't okay with us anymore. So I think people are, leaders are going to be put kind of in the hot seat. I also believe that people, research is showing that our younger workers, millennials and Gen Zs, are not only more quick to expect to be promoted within their organizations, they're also more quick to leave their organizations if they don't feel a value alignment. So attrition is precariously high, but also employees are really demanding that their organization is connected to a mission greater than just profit, and that there's that value alignment. And so if leaders don't catch up, they're going to have disengaged employees who are leaving, who are bouncing around, who are calling them out. I mean, it's kind of a mess for everybody involved. So the issue, is that there's a difference between knowledge and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge is really easy, for, not easy, but it's a lot more accessible to people. I can learn how to, I can learn this particular institution, I can learn or field. I can learn how to, practice this skill set.
Yeah.
Wisdom is knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. And that's what leaders are going to have to get really good at in the coming years.
Stuff. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think I like your distinction. I think knowledge can be can be acquired either by yourself or basically outsourcing. I think wisdom is almost a little bit like it has an element of art, let's say, in addition to an element of science. But what I find very interesting is you said that leaders need to think more paradoxically and more, let's say, need to unify, let's say, constraints or let's say, seeming things that cannot be aligned. How could leaders do that? I mean, is there a particular approach that they could follow? Is there a particular methodology? Could you expand a little bit on that?
It's yes, absolutely. This is not an easy skill set to develop, but it is practicable. Research shows that people who practice mindfulness, actually like meditation, centering practices, practices of that nature, tend to think more paradoxically. They're more able to hold kind of generative tensions, in a productive way with one another. And because oftentimes when we're faced with opposition, something that seems like a paradox, an ethical dilemma, we become cognitively and emotionally overburdened by that paradox. And so one way to practice paradoxical thinking or to improve our paradoxical thinking is actually to practice meditation. But another thing that you can do, and I have some, my current work right now involves 80 leaders across the United States in various industries, half of whom have a mindfulness practice and half of whom do not. And the first group with the mindfulness practice, they engage with paradoxes and contradictions in a very particular way. And what they do, and it seems to be quite effective in improving creativity, is they engage multiple senses when they're dealing with a problem. So they'll think through a problem, they'll talk through the problem, they'll actually feel through the problem, meaning when they're faced with a contradiction or a opposition or a paradox of some sort, dilemma, they'll ask themselves, how does my body feel right now? Am I clutched? Am I hot? Am I sweaty? Am I holding my throat tight because, I'm angry or something like that? And then how does this physical experience likely paint or color or create a lens for how I'm seeing this problem? And then they'll go engage in emotional regulation, downregulate physically before they try to solve the problem. And that seems to be quite effective for increasing their creativity, their response repertoire when it comes to how they can actually, what actions they take to solve. So, mindfulness is really key. Also, another thing that people can do is and this is a little bit hard for all humans because we have this thing called an ego and we don't like questioning ourselves very much. But one thing we can really do is question our assumptions about the problem. You know, what am I believing? What am I telling myself about this? You know, that is constraining what I see as possible when it comes to how I respond to it. And that can be a really challenging thing to do. And oftentimes it's easiest to do with pen and paper.
Yeah.
Sit down and, you know, journal about it. There's simple things, but, you know, leaders oftentimes feel like they don't have enough time in the day. They're moving, they're fast, they're, you know, and research shows us that time constraints actually make dilemmas seem a lot more challenging to solve. So if we can kind of, you know, question, is this really a deadline that I need to solve this by, or is it more like a timeline?
Yeah.
You know, do I have a little space to step back from this thing, journal, question my assumptions, downregulate, and come back to the problem? Can really help.
Now, I think there is a lot of wisdom in what you're saying. It actually reminds me of one of the most inspiring leaders I ever had, who had, let's say, a disagreement with a client. And the client owed him $1 million, something like that. A really, you know, huge amount of money. And I was reporting to him and I said, look, we have a massive problem. We need to address this. We need to find a solution. We need to do something about it. I mean, you know, what is the next step that you envision? And he said, look, he said, currently we have a problem because they are of the opinion that they don't need to pay, whereas I need this money. He said, so at this moment, I don't see any fruitful solution. I think I'll just leave it. And then months later, you know, an opportunity occurred where basically, you know, the seats on the table almost shifted. And basically he was able to find that solution. So I think there's the element of people often having more time than they think they have. The other thing that I found very interesting is what you say, and it reminded me what I recently read of Jennifer Carvey Burger, a coach, who at a certain moment wrote, the stories we tell ourselves. And I think that's very powerful what you said, because she really says that in a lot of situations, we tell ourselves a story that this person is reacting in this way to us because their intentions are X, Y, Z. And if we basically tell ourselves, well, actually, it's a story, and can that story be, you know, rewritten, or can our assumptions be challenged? That's quite often, let's say, a very healthy start for a more, let's say, reflective process.
Right. And, you know, it isn't like just Pollyanna thinking or positive talk, you know, I think it comes down to a lot of what really good leaders do is they actually just ask themselves questions. They engage in a lot of internal dialogue. And so it's really about like asking yourself, is there another way to see this? That doesn't mean I'm putting my head in the sand, right? But is there another way to see this that offers me a little bit more flexibility when it comes to how I can respond to it? And you might find that there isn't a better way to think about it, or there isn't a more expansive, generative way to think about it or frame it. And that's fine too. But sometimes just by asking that question, is there a way to view this that would allow me more creativity when it comes to how I respond? And you know, oftentimes there's something there. And another thing I kind of like to tell when I'm, you know, teaching in the executive MBA level, or I'm guiding people who are leaders in organizations and kind of engage with this work, is leaders oftentimes feel like they have to have all the answers. And there's no, you know, handbook given to a leader that says this, but we just pick this up kind of by the media and our organizational cultures and what we, you know, expected from our leaders. So we feel like we have to have all the answers. And it can be really vulnerable to engage in internal dialogue, self-questioning, questioning our assumptions when we're doing it out loud. So if you have like a trusted mentor, advisor, you know, friend, that's great. Oftentimes the participants in my study, you know, even engage in dialogue at home with their significant others, their spouses, you know, their adult children, things like that, people like that. But sometimes you just can just do it privately and no one needs to know, you know, the self-questioning that you're engaging in, the reflexive practice. No one needs to know. And then when you become a little bit more comfortable leading within that vulnerable space, then maybe you can, you know, mirror that out to people and be a role model when it comes to practicing vulnerability, but you can do it in private first. And I think that's really helpful, because oftentimes leaders will say, well, you know, well, I don't want to, I don't, what if I find that this is a better way to look at it? And then I change my mind, and then I change my mind again. I'm going to seem like I don't know what I'm doing. And that's also because we have this myth of rationality and, Western culture. We feel like we have to,
It's interesting that you say that, because, for instance, we have these iconic leaders who seem to know everything all the time. And one of my favorite examples is, for instance, Steve Jobs. And the idea is that Steve Jobs knew exactly in every situation what to do and how to act. And the interesting thing is that there's a lot of evidence that he basically also came back to earlier decisions he took and basically recontemplated them and came back with another solution. So I think there is this indeed this kind of mis/expectations that leaders always need to know what to do and always need to be consequent and can never, let's say, intelligently reflect if their course of action was the right one. That is, and I think if leaders do that, then I think it's very, very powerful. I mean, I recently heard a CEO who was reflecting with a number of people in a, in a kind of formal setting of a leadership development program. And he was basically saying, look, if I reflect on my first, a couple of months in this company, then I think, here's where I really made inroads. And I honestly wished I had paid more attention to this and I would have done this faster. And it's really, let's say, it's very inspiring. Also for other people, because, they have an idea of, this is a real human being who reflects, in the same way as we are reflecting, and who also, dares to be, ask himself difficult questions in a sense of, what should I have done different in hindsight? So I think it's a very, very healthy development. I think also one of my questions is, all the changes you said about, different expectations from leaders, different roles of companies in society. What does this mean for the way that we prepare students for leadership positions? I mean, you, for instance, teach on Fordham and also do work for other institutions. How do you, let's say, make sure that students are as well as possible prepared for these differences in terms of expectations in the workplace?
Our students over the last 5 years even have, I've noticed that they seem to have a more robust social consciousness and ability to grasp some of these human-centered ideas, more so than even 5 years ago, 7 years ago. And I think that is due to more of a public conversation about, mental health, about human flourishing, well-being, employee engagement. I mean, these conversations are happening on social media and people are more familiar with them and in the news and whatnot. So I think that our young students are really hungry for this type of information or this type of learning. At Fordham, what we do is, and actually I was part of the our sophomore core course on leadership and management. Every student goes through this course at Fordham at some point when they're a business school student. And I was part of the revision a few years ago where we took this course that was originally kind of a, standard traditional organizational behavior, management leadership class. And we redesigned it in keeping all of the nuts and bolts and all of that theories and frameworks, but we redesigned it from a humanistic lens. And so we really should be calling the course Principles of Humanistic Leadership and Management. Although it takes a while to get a title change at university. So we just left it as that. But that's basically what we're doing. And so I think what schools, universities can do, what leadership coaches and executive coaches already are doing and can do is really introduce the humanistic element and, discuss things, teach things such as emotional intelligence, the practice of compassion in the context of leadership, because compassion is a practice. It's not an emotion. It's an act of behavior. Teaching things like how leadership impacts employee well-being and engagement, not simply in service of performance, productivity, and profit, but well-being for its own sake, and that's sort of the paradox of effective leadership and effective business is we're moving away from this model. We've kind of been in this model of just money, 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 profit, 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 more, 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 you know, in capitalist markets for so long that it's hard to really see another alternative. And we're finding that increasingly today, there are very successful businesses that are, you know, operating from a place of, okay, how can we increase employee well-being and make a profit as we're doing it? Grayston Bakery here in Yonkers, New York, they make all the brownies for Ben and Jerry's ice cream, among other delicious treats.
Yeah.
And that's their model. Their model is basically, we make brownies to hire people. We don't hire people to make brownies. We make brownies to hire people. They have this beautiful open hiring model where basically you need a job, you put your name on a list, and when the next job's available, you're hired. No questions, no ifs, ands, or buts, no background checks. And Grayston has, you know, almost single-handedly really helped, you know, restore a community of up in Yonkers of people who, lots of people otherwise would not have access to the workforce. You know, people who were immigrants or people who were priorly incarcerated, stay-at-home mothers, you know, people without college education, or, you know, there's myriad reasons why people have trouble accessing the workforce. And it's a very cyclical problem. You know, you don't get people working, and then the community as a whole is at a disadvantage. And so a company like Grayston, they're really putting employee engagement at the fore, and they're successful and sustainable in the process. You know, Barry Waymiller, Bob Chapman's company, $3 billion company that operates from a truly human leadership model where they put employee well-being first and make a profit as a happy consequence. You know, obviously this seems idealistic to many. You know, most companies don't operate this way, but I see a trend, we see in research, a trend and a shift where organizations are starting to pivot toward more of that well-being consciousness as opposed to just profit or the triple bottom line, you know.
Yeah.
Too. So.
No, but I think that's absolutely, absolutely true. And I think to a certain extent, this is just what you take as the driver or as the starting point, I think. But yeah, let's say the evidence, for instance, around the importance of employee engagement is really overwhelming. And and I think, you know, that engagement stems from, you know, identification with, let's say, what the company stands for, what the company wants to achieve, what you can achieve in your work. It's all about, let's say, that alignment, let's say, what you feel as an individual with your workplace. I think that is... that's a great and I think a very inspiring set of stories. The question I have is, if you look at my line of professional work, I'm involved in leadership development, and it's usually people who have left the workplace, sometimes already a long, long time ago. Do you have any, let's say, experience with, let's say, implementing some of these practices? For what you say, you know, people who have left university already a long time ago, if you will.
Are you talking about current leaders, people who are leaders in organizations today?
Yeah.
You know, this might be my academic bias, but I kind of just assume and expect that everybody is a lifelong learner, should they choose and want to be. And so I think that people who already have been leading for a really long time, you know, they probably have a level of wisdom already that they've gained in response to the zeitgeist of the time in which they became a leader.
They had to adapt themselves in different changing circumstances time. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that will continue, you know, that will continue as long as humans are engaging in social groups, you know, AKA organizing. So for people who are currently in leadership positions, having a kind of a spirit of inquiry and curiosity and asking, you know, how can I learn and adapt and change now? It's, you know, there is this kind of adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I don't buy it at all. I think that's not even remotely true. I think that everybody is a little uncomfortable with change, but that's when learning and growth happens. It doesn't matter if you're 15 or you're 55 or you're 75, your change is uncomfortable. And people can always learn. In fact, there's a lot of research on, I'm not a neuroscientist, but there's research on, you know, neuroscience and neurology that looks at the plasticity of people's brains, you know, and how malleable how we can continue to learn. So I would say for someone for people who are in leadership positions currently, one, recognize that we are in the middle of quite turbulent times. Turbulence doesn't have to be a bad thing. It's just transformative. you know, can be uncomfortable. Two, there are myriad resources online today, and you know, excellent resources like your blog, you know, your videos and your other products. There are excellent resources and podcasts. I highly recommend, if you want to, you know, amplify your leadership, don't go listen to a leadership podcast solely. You know, use a leadership podcast as the foundation, and then go, you know, listen to, can I plug other podcasts here? Is this okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no problem.
Okay. On Being with Krista Tippett is phenomenal. Philosophy, you know, theology, poetry. It's beautiful. I also love listening to different spiritual podcasts from various faith traditions and wisdom traditions. Wisdom really comes from a comprehensive engagement with the whole. So instead of focusing on just one thing, like I want to be a better leader, I like to reframe the question, how can I be a more effective human? Yeah. And how can I use that, you know, to produce or encourage not just my own flourishing, but flourishing for the people in my span of care? So it's really about, like, you know, increasing our human wisdom, which will then trickle out into the spaces with, you know, where we have influence, such as our organizations, our communities, our families, et cetera.
No, I strongly believe that. I think that broad orientation also enables people to somehow connect the dots between, you know, different aspects of life. And I think we live, let's say, we are whole human beings in, let's say, an environment that is also, let's say, a holistic entity. And I think if we limit our interactions between, you know, what you said, this is my compartment workplace and this is my compartment being a leader, that's a very, very narrow way to define your existence for at least 8 to 12 hours a day. So I would fully agree with that. Yeah.
And, you know, I think to this focus, this overemphasis on being a leader, it does a couple of things. It does a disservice in a couple of ways, even if you hold a leadership title. And one is you're thinking about your behavior. We're goal-oriented, you know, creatures. And so when we think about our behavior in the context of leadership, we are inherently tying what we're doing to a capitalist ethos and to profit, which is fine, but it's one piece of the larger pie. So instead of thinking, how can I be a better leader? I like to think, how can I be a better human and lead more effectively? Lead being a verb, not a noun. You know, it's not who I am. It's what I do. It's something I'm doing. And then in that same vein, we can think of leadership not as a personality trait, which is what we used to think with the earliest leadership theories.
Yeah.
You know, I was born this way or I wasn't. That, you know, that's pretty much been debunked as a myth to a certain extent. There are people who may have a more of a proclivity for leaderly behaviors, but, you know, we can teach people how, no matter who they are, introvert, extrovert, you know, to be more leaderly, to be a better leader. So, you know, it's not really who you are inherently necessarily. It doesn't really reflect all behaviors. It reflects a very specific kind of behavior. It reflects communicative behavior. So I like to think of leadership as emerging in our communication. That's where leadership exists. It doesn't exist inside of me or between my ears. It exists between you and me in how we show up to that dialogue or conversation, be it, you know, a vocal, verbal conversation, nonverbal communication, text, email, podcast, you know, a meeting memo. Leadership can emerge in any of these communicative kind of areas, and how we communicate, whether we frame something as an opportunity or a crisis, you know, how we ask questions, how we listen to our subordinates or to our, you know, stakeholders, all of that is where leadership shows up. And I think that's really important, because then you can have people, if you think of leadership as communication and not as something you're born with, then you could have somebody who's an entry-level employee who's enacting leadership every single day. And guess what? Through their communication, and they're going to get noticed likely and develop that self-efficacy and then get promoted. And, you know, so it makes, think of leadership as communication, makes it more ephemeral and makes it a little less like you don't have it or own it. You just do it. But I think there's something really powerful about that also.
Yeah, I would fully agree with you. I think for me, it is to a large extent let's say, also linked to the capability to engage others. And one of, let's say, the things that I always find interesting, and that's what I recently also published a blog post about, is, let's say, are you attached to, a position or achieving a certain position, or let's say to your mission? And the difficulty is that if you're only attached to a position or strive to have a position, that's not really inspiring for people around you or for your team, in a sense of, you know, what's in it for us, basically, if you basically, you know, do one step in the corporate ladder. But if you basically say, look, this is a mission, and I think it would be great if we as a team, as a company, or as a community would achieve certain things, it's for people infinitely more easy to identify themselves with what that purpose is that you're trying to achieve, rather than, let's say, with your personal, you know, gains or wins if you achieve, let's say, a certain position. Well, on a different topic, in our pre-discussion, you said something that really, really struck my attention. And it was a notion that I hadn't heard before, but which sounded really intriguing and very powerful, is the power of curiosity. And then, especially in the context of motivation, can you tell a little bit about your thinking in that area?
Well, so research on motivation has shown for a very long time that people have kind of two primary forms of motivation. First is intrinsic motivation, and the second is extrinsic motivation. And, and simply, you know, intrinsic motivation is our inherent curiosity. We do something because we actually enjoy it. You know, like, I live in New York City. I love to just go on walks outside, not because I'm going anywhere, just so I can walk around the block four times. I just enjoy being in the city, right? So I'm intrinsically motivated. Extrinsic motivation is either rewards or punishments. You know, I do something because I want to get promoted. I want a bonus. I don't do something because I don't want to get fired, that sort of thing. So, but along this spectrum, there are actually various other forms of motivation that are a little more extrinsic, but look intrinsic to us. So for example, there's something called introjected motivation. So I avoid doing something, not because I'm going to get punished, because I don't want to embarrass myself. I want to avoid ridicule. I want to avoid judgment. So I'm doing something that I think I'm doing on my own volition, but actually I really just want to, you know, kind of save face or engage in impression management. And so that's why I'm really doing it. So I think it's intrinsic, but in actuality, it's not. So that is a really important to sort of, when we talk about leaders being self-aware and self-questioning, asking ourselves, why am I doing this? Is it because I have inherent curiosity, or is it because I want to look like the type of person that does this thing? And then a little further, a little bit further or closer to intrinsic motivation is this idea of identified motivation. And identified motivation, we also believe we're doing something for ourselves, but really we're doing something because we want to be the kind of person that does this thing. So it's kind of close to the other one, but it's really because, you know, I jog every day. Why? Because I actually don't do this. This is just an example. If I jogged every day, well, you know, I want to be the kind of person that lives a healthy life. Don't really care about other people's opinions, but I just want to be that for myself. That can feel and smell a lot like intrinsic motivation, but when you really ground down to it, there is a level of extrinsicness in it, because it's not tied or motivated inherently solely by our internal curiosity and enjoyment. So there's something else, even if it's self-inflicted, putting pressure. And so it's really important for leaders to identify, or people, employees too, or just people living their lives, to identify why we behave in certain ways. And then notice, I think this is why human behavior is so interesting. Notice, ooh, okay, say I'm working on this task. This happened to me last week. I was submitting a research manuscript for revision and I had a deadline coming up. And I noticed that I was getting kind of stressed out and annoyed at how long the process was taking me. I was kind of like, oh, you know, I'm so glad this thing is due on Saturday because I'm just so done with this. I want to move on to my next project. So I was having all of these kind of unpleasant feelings. And I realized, wow, the reason I'm feeling these things is because I have an external deadline. This is external, you know, extrinsic motivation, right? I want to get this thing published. So I've got this external deadline that I'm coming up against. But actually, if I step back a layer, Okay, introjected motivation has a is playing part here too, because I don't want this thing to not get published. That would be, I realized I was thinking that I would find that embarrassing, even though I shouldn't, because, you know, manuscripts get rejected for academics all the time. We get rejected all the time. But I was thinking, well, you know, I've been talking about this with my colleagues. I don't want it to get rejected. That might be a little embarrassing. And then I had one step closer to my internal. I thought, well, actually, there's also an identified motivation thing at play here too, because I'm starting to think of myself as someone who's published, you know, I've been pretty prolific the last couple of years. So I think of myself as a serious researcher.
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
kind of at play here. And then I'm like, man, no wonder this project's really feeling kind of icky. Like I've got all of this other gunk in the way. And I had to come all the way to the very end and think, well, why did I start this project? I started this project because I think this research is fascinating. I'm really interested in it. And oh yeah, I'm curious. When I moved, went across down the spectrum from purely extrinsic to introjected to identified all the way to intrinsic motivation. Once I got to intrinsic motivation, I flew through the rest of that revision. It was fun. It was much easier. I got it done in about 6 hours, but I'd been kind of begrudgingly, you know, going through the last couple of days. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? So oftentimes when we have a project, we're engaged in something, it's not like we're only motivated by one or the other. All of them can be at play. But one of the things we can do to become more motivated, to feel better while we're doing it, is to identify the various aspects that are motivating us and then remember our intrinsic motivation for whatever the thing is. It can be really powerful.
Thank you. That is, let's say, a great and very practical tip, and I'll definitely remember that one. Thank you, Sophia, so much for this interview and for answering diligently all my questions. I learned a lot from it, and I'm sure, let's say, listeners to this podcast will as well. Are there any topics that we haven't touched based on? But which you found important in the context of leadership, motivation, learning, where you would like to say anything more about?
Thank you for that. Yes, I would actually. I'd like to leave listeners with this idea. It's a tripartite framework of how we learn and how we engage with new material. And this really grounds down into the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge being knowing what to do knowledge being knowing what to do when you know what to do, and wisdom being knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. Okay, so there's a difference there. And the framework is that when we learn new things, we have the opportunity to engage our knowing, which is conceptual grasp of that new material, our doing, which is the practical skills required to effectively interact with that new material, and the being, which is your natural enactment, your embodied enactment of that thing. So if you take an idea like leadership, knowing would be knowing frameworks, knowing theories, you know, knowing some words, some language, some vocabulary around leadership, which will only get you so far. You know, you can maybe take a test on, you know, what is leadership? Give me a definition A, B, and C. But when you're thrown in a hot situation and you need to act, knowing's not, conceptual understanding is not going to get you that far. Doing is practical skills. The only way to develop this is to actually act it out, to do it. So having a dialogue partner, you know, practicing, you know, your leadership, practicing your communication, maybe fumbling, realizing it didn't go great, standing up, dusting yourself off and trying again. So practice. Over time, practice will then oftentimes transition into that being, you know, element, that enacted natural embodiment of leadership. And wisdom lives across that whole spectrum, but wisdom requires that third piece. So in order to be a wise leader, you have to have the knowing, doing, and being of leadership. And the number one thing we can do, this really, is the case for any topical domain when it comes to the being element of learning, but especially in leadership, I think we can really see this for ourselves. The number one thing we can do to amplify that leadership, that third leadership learning dimension of being, is self-awareness and self-reflection. Absolutely critical. If you don't have self-awareness and self-reflection, you won't really progress on that third dimension, or not nearly as swiftly. And so that's where, like, having internal dialogue, self-questioning, you know, asking someone close to you, hey, you know, I'm trying to identify by blind spots, someone you trust. Can you help me out here? You know, if you could describe me in three words in when I'm faced with conflict, how would you describe me? Asking a close friend, if you could describe me in three words, when I'm at my best, how would you describe me? You know,
moments that matter. Yeah.
Yes. And we don't do that. We feel like it's navel gazing or we don't want to hear the answer, but we don't often, as you know, humans don't give themselves time to self-reflect, and it's vital for important, for leadership when we're faced with important decisions, which is most of the time over leaders. So.
Super. Well, thank you so much, Sophia, for your time and for the interview and for sharing so much of your thinking and research in this area. And looking forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much.